You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
It's 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon. My name's Jacob, here with you on Community Radio Station 3CR, and this is a Friday Rave.
Yes, it's Friday again, and if you're listening, you're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 on your AM dial in Melbourne through 3CR Digital, via all the W's at 3cr.org.au. However you're listening and wherever you're listening, I hope you're having a nicer day than I'm having in the bush in New South Wales, where it's raining down, it's cold, and there it was, I'm thinking it was spring. Anyway, it's a big week. I'm not sure where I'm going to end up today, but I want to have a look at the broader geopolitical situation and the financial situation which underpins it, I guess. I've spoken a fair bit in recent weeks about the war in Ukraine, China phobia, global finance, Australia's defence posture, but I don't think I've really taken the opportunity of putting them all together. So I don't know where I'm going to end up, but I'm going to start in India, because it's a key player in everything that's going on. You don't hear a lot about its role. You know, India is the seventh largest country in the world by area. I think it's the second most in population, about 1.5 billion people. It's an important country, and Australia is getting more and more tied in with India. They were there at Operation Pitch Black. They're part of the Quad, of course, but they play a funny role. Now, as listeners would be aware, India, you know, as I said, is part of the Quad with Japan, the US, and of course Australia, and it's taken part in military exercises, not just Pitch Black ended the other day, but in things like Malabar and the Indian Ocean, aimed at containing China, ostensibly. But India's in a bit of a funny situation with China, largely because of their border disputes in the north of India, along the border with the Indian state of Ladakh. And, Ladakh is on the border with China's Xinjiang province. Now, on its own, this little area is not much more than a mountainous region with very little economic resources, but it's important geographically, as not only would China taking control of this be a step closer to China connecting directly with Pakistan proper, as opposed to Pakistan-administered Kashmir, whole other story, but the area contains the route, the border where India and China are conflicting on the border. It's the main road, which was recently upgraded, between Tibet and Xinjiang, which is two of China's most problematic provinces. So, anyway, the trigger for my wanting to talk about India today was the news that both China and India increased oil purchases from Russia have offset the effects of Western sanctions on Russia. India in particular have increased their oil intake from Russia from just 2/3 of a million tonnes in the first quarter of this year to 8.5 million in the second quarter. That's a whopping increase in anyone's language, but that's only the start of it. And before I get too much further, I've already caught myself catching myself about to qualify what I said about Tibet and Xinjiang, being two of China's most problematic provinces. When I'm talking about India, China, Russia, whatever today, I'm not going to go into the internal politics. I'm going to try and focus on the inter-country relationships, and I don't want to get hung up on things like referring to Tibet as a Chinese province or to Pakistan-administered Kashmir. Whatever your thoughts on things like that, that's the actual state of affairs. Anyway, India has increased its purchase of Russian oil 14-fold at a time when its partners in the Quad and their European allies are imposing sanctions which are sending domestic European energy prices soaring right in the middle of a heatwave. Now, this ensures that the West sanctions do not fully enact their stated intention of hurting Russia, but whether intended or not, turn the effects of sanctions back on the citizens of the countries that imposed them. To a lesser degree, our increased fuel and energy costs are not really hurting Russia, but mainly ourselves. The people, that is. Because the oil conglomerates are, of course, and as ever, looking after each other, their class. But this is but one way that India is having a big impact on the war in Ukraine, putting its financial purchasing power to play against the West. And more on that later. Because really, and it is against the West, because really, you're either for them or against them. At the same time as they're playing a part within the West's anti-China military plans. Now, I mentioned a few weeks ago that the BRICS summit happened virtually this year in June, hosted by China. Now, BRICS, for those who don't know, who weren't listening, is a group of countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, who are opposed to the current state of Western global hegemony. Let me say something about the BRICS announcement, that they're looking to establish a basket reserve currency and actually set up a special drawing fund. Now, when I say basket currency, what I mean and what the term means is putting their currencies together, but not necessarily replacing the yuan or the ruble as the euro did some years ago, but in linking their currencies at fixed rates while maintaining their own independent systems. The reason for doing this is to create a reserve currency for international use. At the moment, the international reserve currency is, of course, the US dollar. This means that if, for example, Australia wants to buy some product from, I don't know, Thailand or sell something to, you know, wherever, France, it doesn't do it in either dollars or baht or whatever, but in US dollars. Dominating global trade's reserve currency is one of the ways the US maintains its power abroad. In fact, it's always been the way. Excuse me. Controlling the currency everyone uses. It wasn't always a dollar. Once upon a time, it was the British sterling. Now, there is, of course, a sensible need for a commonly accepted reserve currency. That's what currency is about. It's an international version, excuse me, of the dollar. While everybody's happy with a currency, particularly as it holds its value, spend money would be fritter away the children's inheritance, sort of smashed avocado and toasted a long black coffee. We're doing so, and the restaurateur's doing so, in the understanding that, you know, that 20 Australian dollars is redeemable for $20 worth of whatever else. And while everyone's happy with the currency, particularly thinking or knowing it would hold its value, and that the administrators of the currency, I guess, don't constantly change the rules, there aren't any problems. No one's saying that money in itself as a concept, or I'm not saying, is a bad thing. But many countries are not happy with the way the United States has manipulated its currency to gain a very unfair advantage. Nor with the way the US uses other factors to bolster the US dollar as the only possible reserve currency, including war, including diplomatic pressure, which is war by other means. When the British sterling was reserve, however, it was backed by gold and silver. It was as good as gold because it was gold. You could take a US pound and transfer it to gold. You could buy back the gold. All it was a way of saying you had this much worth of gold. That's basic what currency is, and it worked internationally as well as just at a domestic level. The US dollar used to be backed by gold as well, but then there was what was known as the Nixon shock in of the early 70s during the oil crisis. And Nixon announced that the US dollar would no longer be backed by gold reserves. The dollar then and now is only really as good as the US government, as the Reserve Bank, says it is. And when you hear about the currency fluctuations and the printing, what you're doing is, what the discussion really is how much the US can get away with, because it can upvalue or devalue its currency at will because it's got no gold or any other resource backing, but it can only do it within the certain parameter that the rest of the world is going to put up with. As an example, at a local level, if we said, you know, some commodity, people trade in other commodities than dollars in Australia, whether you're talking about, you know, an ounce of pot or some football playing cards, it doesn't matter. You know that that commodity is worth a certain amount of other things, whether it's dollars or otherwise. Now, the person in charge of that commodity can say this is now worth 5% more or 5% less than it was when you bought it, and we put up with that. But if we were to say it's now worth only half or it's worth double, then we're not going to put up with that. We'll get our backs up and we'll no longer use that alternative currency. Okay? And that's what the US government always does. It balances what it can get away with the other countries and the rest of the world, not the people, but the corporations and the banks, accepting that they say the US dollar is worth. And that's why they determine the daily rate, always, in a way that favours US-based corporations and attracts, or not attracts, but keeps the rest of the world relatively happy with using the US dollar. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, that so many Chinese companies are listed on NASDAQ, because the rate of the dollar is determined by the Federal Reserve to benefit the companies listed on NASDAQ, to benefit so-called American companies, even though some of the American companies are actually Chinese, just like most of the Australian companies are actually foreign-owned as well. But with the US over the years changing its dollar value by basically printing more money or putting money away, there have been, and that's literal, printing more money. There have been attempts over the course of, I don't know, the last century, the last 20-odd years, this century, to end dependence on the US dollar. Now, this has become so, what's the word, widespread, that it's got its own term, and that's known as de-dollarization. Now, one of the most notable attempts in recent years of de-dollarization was Muammar Gaddafi's moves to create a pan-Arabic oil-backed currency. And this is, of course, why Secretary of State Clinton was so keen to get rid of him on behalf of her Wall Street mates. Now, back to India. India has itself moved a little way along the path of de-dollarization. In a whole lot of small things, it's just in the last couple of days banned rice exports to certain countries. It's in the last couple of days limited, not ended, but severely limited, arms imports as part of a Made in India campaign. And underpinning that, of course, is the knowledge that arms exports by the US are a major part of keeping debt and obligation in US dollars. But that's another story. India isn't in a strong financial position to go it alone just yet. No one country really is. Hence the move towards a BRICS basket currency. Anyway, I hope that wasn't too complicated. The news that BRICS is moving along, developing a new currency, comes as no surprise. As I said, there have been many de-dollarization attempts and many, in fact, bilateral agreements to trade in currency other than the dollar. But the BRICS initiative moves well beyond that. If it comes off, it means that two countries outside of BRICS, say Saudi Arabia and Turkey, could use the currency. And Saudi Arabia have already expressed an interest as has Turkey and Egypt and Argentina, along with plenty of others. Now, while this process has been going on for some time, it became rather more urgent for Russia when, back in March this year, the United States cut Russia off from the SWIFT, something that they'd threatened to do back in 2014 with the war in Crimea. Now, when they cut Russia off from the SWIFT, it in fact froze about $500 billion of Russia's reserve fund. It'd be like you've got money in the bank, but they cut you off from using the FPOS system. That's basically what they done. The SWIFT, fully it's the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Transactions, is a system, it's a private company actually, based in Belgium, but controlled by member nations, or rather member currencies. And as the US dollar is the most traded, is the reserve currency by an order of magnitude, the US Federal Reserve basically calls the shots on who's in and out of SWIFT. Now, much of the West, including Australia, lauded the action of cutting Russia out of SWIFT, saying it was a non-violent, non-military reaction. But many other countries saw the move as a very dire warning, because you're cutting off someone's money. Look what happened in Afghanistan when they cut the Taliban out of the whole financial system, and then turned around a couple of weeks later and said it's a failed state. Of course it's a failed state. Now, but cutting the Taliban from international currency transactions is one thing, but if the US could do that to Russia, they could do it to anyone. And that's a dire warning to the rest of the world. Back to India for a moment. When Russia was cut out of SWIFT in March this year, India reacted by immediately offering Russia a way around. They struck an agreement between the two countries that had the Reserve Bank of India using a Russian system known as the SPFS. All right, what's that? Well, back in 2014, as I said, during the war in Crimea, when America threatened to cut Russia out of the SWIFT but stopped short, the Central Bank of Russia developed an alternative to SWIFT known as the SPSF. I won't attempt to mangle the Russian language, but it translates as System for Transfer of Financial Messages. It's basically a rival to SWIFT, and while it hasn't taken off universally, it has been growing steadily, mainly amongst ex-Soviet states in Eurasia. But, individual banks, you don't have to have whole nations signing up to it. Individual banks can sign up to SWIFT, and I think they said they've got 800 banks or something so far. A year after that, 2015, probably seen the writing on the wall, China began its own SWIFT alternative, what they call the Cross-Border Interbank Payment System, or KIPS. Now, KIPS has been somewhat more successful than the SPSF because, of course, of China's huge trading power. Even some Australian banks have signed up to KIPS. So what we're actually seeing here with the BRICS announcement, the BRICS move, if it comes off, is, I guess, you can call it little more than a motherhood-type statement, encompassing the deals between India's Internal Financial System Code, the IFSC, KIPS and the SPFS. And this is more than just a natural transition, a natural development of these growing currencies. It's more than an idea, its time has come. It's acknowledged as a direct attack on the global hegemony of the Yankee dollar. As Xi Jinping put it in June, hang on, where is it? Here it is. And I quote, "Politicizing, instrumentalizing and weaponizing the world economy, using a dominant position in the global financial system to wantonly impose sanctions would only hurt others as well as hurting oneself, leaving people around the world suffering. Those who obsess with a position of strength, expand their military alliances and seek their own security at the expense of others will only fall into a security conundrum." End of quote. Now, we've all heard and used the term blowback before. Blowback, of course, is where sometimes, not always, covert action in the military sense has the unintended consequences of a return attack. An example, 9/11 was widely described as a blowback to US intervention in the Middle East. It's usually used militarily because the term blowback comes from the occasional misfiring, a rear discharge from a gun that kills or even wounds the person that fired it rather than the person it was aimed at. Nonetheless, though not strictly military, I would think what we're seeing here with the financial manoeuvrings within and around BRICS can be seen as a blowback situation from the West hubris in using their dominant position to, as it was put, instrumentalise and weaponise the world economy. It could be a major shot in the war behind the wars, the war for financial dominance. You're listening to Community Radio, Radical Radio, 855 AM in Melbourne, 3CR. The Friday Rave with me, Jacob. Anyway, the changing of the world's financial systems, even in the attempts in change at the moment, because the BRICS move is not a fait accompli, but it's moving there. It's got another factor, and that's the whole change in global focus. For years, since it became an Australian government buzzword or buzz phrase, more to the point, back in, 2015, I've been taking the piss out of the term the global rules-based order, one where I say they make the rules and we follow the orders. The global rules-based order was defined in the Department of Defence's white paper in 2016 as, and I quote, a shared commitment by all countries to conduct their activities in accordance with agreed rules which evolve over time, such as international law and regional security arrangements, end quote. As I said back then, this was a set of rules that only a part of the world accepted. Notably, countries including China and Russia were never involved and never accepted that there was a global rules-based order outside of the UN, which I'll get to. But, it wasn't just me. There were also, it wasn't just radical lefties who were getting their back up about this. Insiders were as well, or at least some of them. People like former Royal Australian Navy Commander Richard Menenik, who wrote in 2018 in ASPE, no less, that we should be alert and alarmed, a term he used, about the whole concept of a global rules-based order that is not signed, what's the word, well, how did he put it, that the globe is not signed up to, in short. And he suggested that we stick to the principles of Article 1 of the United Nations that we all did sign up to. But it's my argument that the whole concept of the global rules-based order has been nothing short of an attempt to undermine Article 1. Things like an expanded and increasingly politicised NATO, new arrangements like AUKUS and the Quad and the like, you know, the politicisation of the Five Eyes in recent years. They're all aimed at removing the authority of the United Nations. That, as imperfect as it was, at least was recognised as an authority and an arbiter. With, you know, replacing that is what they're attempting to do with some form of neoliberal laissez-faire arrangement that we all know what the rules are and we don't feel the need to articulate them, let alone ratify them. The global rules-based order, what are they? No one can tell us because they're a laissez-faire system that's made up as it goes along. And they need to do that, because once you ratify a system like they did with the United Nations, you have a problem that both Russia and China, along with the US, UK and France, have veto power over anything their Security Council decides. Now, this started becoming problematic back in the days of the war against Iraq, when rather than a UN mandate, the US used what it called a coalition of the willing. Now, this coalition of the willing, was the germ that started the whole idea of the global rules-based order. Now, this order is based, of course, in the West. And what we're seeing with BRICS and other moves around the world is not only a reaction against it, but the building of an alternative, of a multipolar world. The shifting of focus from Western Europe to Eurasia. Geographically, an area with about half the world's population. Remember that BRICS includes Brazil, the fifth biggest country in the world by area and sixth by population. you know, though Brazil is perhaps of the BRICS nations the least ideologically committed to shaking off the yoke of Western hegemony, maybe if it was sure of financial support, it'll come around. It's the, of all those nations, the most tied in to the US. BRICS also includes South Africa, the second biggest economy in Africa, and I think 60-odd million people in its own right. BRICS could be seen, I guess, as being two-tiered. The Eurasian non-Western powerhouses of China, India and Russia on the one hand, and the emerging economies of South Africa and Brazil on the other, both of which have abundant resources and could also act as springboards for the other BRICS nations in resource-rich Africa and South America. South American countries like Venezuela and Bolivia, not to mention Cuba, with their own, issues of US influence, could well soon become involved. Now, particularly something I didn't mention earlier, though I meant to, think I alluded to it, was a discussion about BRICS basket currency setting up a special drawing fund akin to the IMF, an expansion of China's new development bank, which has been growing since its inception in 2014. Anyway, any real expansion or implementation of this kind of fund, which would be the next obvious step after the bedding in of a basket currency, would see developing nations in South America and Africa being really put on the spot. We're seeing it in a very small way. With, strangely enough, something I've just been made aware of the golf, with the LIV, Greg Norman's new golfing tour, taking people away from the US, whatever it's called, the pros, the US Open Championship, the money just in the golfing world, which I don't follow at all, but I've been staying with a bloke who does, and being moved out of the United States. And it's a very, if you have 10 minutes to spend looking at this thing, it's very interesting about the movement of money out of the United States, in something as basic as golf. But anyway, it's about the moving of money. Resources, it's about resources. Remember, with BRICS, no one's talking about changing from an exploitative extraction-based capitalist economy. No one's talking about changing the world, the way the world runs. No one's talking about changing rules of monopoly, just who always gets a chance to be banker. Just rearranging the monopoly money. It's in the developing nations of South America and Africa where the resources are. And these resources are already being fought for between BRICS, led by China and Russia on the one hand, and the West, in the form of the US and to a lesser extent the UK and France on the other. The expansion of Chinese capital in Africa, coupled with the huge increase of US military operations there, particularly along the Sahel, are already the real battleground for the West versus BRICS influence. To date, this has taken the form of US destabilization of national governments through military support in efforts to keep pro-Western governments in place that are friendly to Western resource extraction interests. Remember, even Australia has 200 mining companies operating across Africa, often supported by corrupt governments spending their wealth in buying US arms to put down any anti-Western ideologically driven insurgencies, but that's a whole nother rave. Meanwhile, China's new development bank has been funding projects left, right and centre as part of their Belt Road initiative. Now, how does this relate back to Ukraine? In short, Ukraine, as I've said from the start, isn't about Ukraine. It's a proxy war between the superpowers and their currencies. But more than that, figuratively, Ukraine sits at the border of East and West. While we see it and refer to it as Western Europe, there's a big part of the world that actually sees it as Eastern Eurasia. That's all I've got time for today. I'll be back to rave at you more next week to tell you just how fucked up the world is. Take care till then.